In addition to the lost text in the biblical traditions that we know in the West today, interestingly, a similar edit process happened with some of the most cherished traditions in the Hebrew text as well. By going back into the original versions of some of the most ancient wisdom, I believe that we have the opportunity to see firsthand, through the eyes of the ancients, those who have come before us, their perspective, their understandings of precisely what our relationship to the forces of nature around us and to one another, precisely what that means and how it works in our world. So the clues from some of our most ancient records, the ancient 4th century Hebrew book of Haggadah, for example. The book of Haggadah contains many Hebrew texts that were removed from their Bible, as well as other religious documents, especially what is considered to be the non-legal part of the book of the Talmud. When we go into the Haggadah texts, the texts are very, very clear and tremendously detailed about the creation of humankind. For example, in the book of Genesis, we would like to see how our bodies were created or where we came from. We see something roughly akin to, in the beginning, not much was happening, then there were a lot of things happening, and we were created from the dust of the earth, and that God breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and we became animated and walked upon this earth. And that's a gross oversimplification of a very brief section in the book of Genesis. In the Haggadah text, for example, we're given tremendous detail into the powers that were given to humankind as we were created in this earth, and precisely what those powers mean to us. And perhaps one of the best ways to understand precisely what these powers are all about is with a single sentence. In the book of Haggadah, we're told that the creation of humankind is unique in all of the universe. And this is a quote. We're told that humankind is the only one who is created by the hand of God. All other creatures, according to the text, were created by the Word of God. So they're making a distinction between God physically intervening, creating us by His own hand, and how other creatures were created essentially by a command. And this kind of information comes from a section of the Haggadah that is entitled Man and the World. So if readers would like to find more about this, you can go and read in the book of Haggadah from the section Man and the World. Man and the World continues by describing male and female, man and woman in our world, how we're created as literally a bridge, a living bridge between heaven and earth, how within each of us we embody very specific elements of the heavens given to no other creatures on the earth, and how within each of us we embody elements of creatures of the earth that no angels in the heavens have ever experienced before. And I think this is fascinating. It's fascinating to consider that according to this text, we are the single life form throughout the universe which is empowered with a combination of angelic and earthly powers. The book of Haggadah, for example, describes precisely which powers were imbued into the bodies of humankind from the angels of the heavens, and which powers come from what they describe as the beasts of the earth. From the angels of the heavens, the first power they describe, it's the power of speech. And we know that with the power of speech, we can speak the words that soothe and comfort, or we can speak the words that destroy the feelings and the emotions and the lives of another person. Number two, we were given the power of what is called discriminating intellect. According to the text of Haggadah, we are the only creatures in the universe that are given the power to think about the consequences of our choices before we make those choices. Discriminating intellect, we can consider the implications of the actions before we carry out those actions. We are given, number three, our power of what is called upright walk. And by having the power of upright walk, we are freeing our arms so that we can hold and love and comfort one another in ways, apparently, that no other creatures throughout the universe are able to do. And number four, and perhaps the most powerful, it says we are given the power of the glance of our eyes. And you and I know that when we look at one another, we know what those looks are like. We have the ability, through the glance of our eyes, we can look at another person and we can offer soothing, loving, comfort, and support. Or we can look at another person with a disapproving look that brings them to their knees and destroys the confidence in those that we love and hold dear. We're given those powers. So the powers of the angels in the heavens, the power of speech, the power of discriminating intellect, the power of upright walk, the power of the glance of our eyes. From the beasts of the earth, the Haggadah texts say that we were given four powers as well. We were given, first of all, the power and the ability to eat and drink, giving life and sustenance to our bodies. The angels of the heavens apparently do not have to eat and drink. We were given the ability to secrete the waste in our bodies. Number two. Number three, we are given our ability to propagate our species. And number four, we are given what is called the choice of death. It is these powers of the angels in heaven and the beasts of the earth that the Haggadah texts say were merged for the first time, imbued into a single being that we call humankind. And with these powers was given an instruction by those responsible for our creation. And the text goes on to say that we were given the choice to either live as the angels of the heavens live, or to die as the beasts of the earth die, and that through the powers imbued in our bodies, if we get lost in the abilities of eating and drinking, if we get lost in the experience of propagating our species, if we live as the beasts of the earth and we die as beasts of the earth, if we honor the principles of the angels in heavens, then we live as angels in the heavens. And I'm sharing this, again, just to give an example of the kind of information, the detail that we find in other texts that we do not find in our more recent, more edited texts. What we find are general summaries. For example, from the edited versions of the Christian Bible, if we are asked how we were formed in this earth, we're simply told the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. It's a very brief, very concise statement. While it may be accurate, it does not carry a lot of detail. This is from the book Genesis 2, chapter 7. I'd like to stop here now just for a moment, just to take a moment and reflect on the power of the information that we have just been given through the recovery of this text. In the language of another time, in the ancient book of the Haggadah, we're given the secret that tells us that within each of us, we personally embody the powers of both the angels of the heavens as well as the creatures that live this earth. And if we're to believe these texts, for the very first time ever, anywhere in creation, we are the marriage of those powers. What does that mean to us in our lives? What does it mean to you? How do you feel knowing that this kind of power lives within your body? And what does it mean to us? Have we found a way to balance our powers? God says to us in the language of the Haggadah, He says that we're given the powers of the angels of the heavens, and we're given the gifts of the beasts of the earth, and that it's up to us. It's a personal choice. It's not mandated. It is left completely up to us as to which kinds of lives we choose to use. He says that if we live the lives and honor the principles of the angels of the heavens, then our lives are eternal as the angels of the heavens. And if we live our lives as the beasts of the earth, if we get lost in what it means to be able to place food into our bodies and the elimination of the food in our bodies, the propagation of our species and our preoccupation of or for avoiding death, then in that preoccupation, we then die as the beasts of the earth. I believe that our greatest challenge in walking between the worlds of heaven and earth maybe to find that balance, to find the balance that allows us to honor all of these experiences on the one hand without getting lost in any one of them on the other hand. So I invite you to just take a moment to reflect, to look into your life. Have you found the balance of what it means to eat and drink and honor the principles of the angels of the earth? Do you eat and drink only when you're hungry or thirsty, or do we do so for other reasons, to fulfill other needs? The propagation of our species has become almost a pastime in some of the media and the entertainment. What does it mean to you? How sacred is it to you in your life? What does it mean to you to honor our ability to interact with another human in this way? Death. What does death mean to you in your life? Is it something that you avoid and pursue and spend time trying to avoid? Or is it something that you embrace? Or is it something you look forward to? Or is it something that we simply acknowledge as a part of our existence? Does it have a place of balance in our lives? This is an opportunity, a tremendous opportunity, through the eyes of the ancients, to recognize, because it is through the gift of the recovery of these kinds of texts that we recognize what it is that we were given so long ago, the role that these gifts play in our lives, and the opportunity to balance them, to put them into perspective, so that we may truly walk in balance and honor not only one another, but honor ourselves in this gift that we call life. So as we begin to understand that those who have come before us had an understanding, had a knowledge, had a wisdom of our relationship to the world, and if we can somehow bring that wisdom and merge it into what science is telling us today, we may in fact build the most complete understanding of our relationship to our world, perhaps, than we've had for a very, very long time. Well, it is from these ancient understandings as well that those who have come before us suggest that we are, in fact, directly related to the world around us and to one another in a way that perhaps we're only beginning to understand here in the West. In the traditions of the native peoples of the world, we're reminded that there is literally a web, what they call a net, that links all of creation. And we see this in the native traditions throughout the world, in the traditions of the Hopi, for example, the American Desert Southwest. In the Hopi understandings, at the beginning of this world that we're experiencing now, a being known as Spider Grandmother emerged into this world, and the first thing she did was to weave the web of creation so that her grandchildren could experience life and know themselves in the presence of one another in this world. In the Buddhist traditions, we hear something very, very similar. In the Buddhist sutras, there's a sutra that actually says, far away in the great heavenly abode of the god Indra, there exists a wonderful net stretching in all directions. It's actually described as a net. As we go into these traditions, whether we're looking at the Tibetan or the Buddhist or the Native American or the pre-Christian or the Christian traditions, what we're finding is that there are universal themes, common threads of understanding. If we could summarize those into a couple of key points, those points will lead us into some of the most modern, some of the most sophisticated, some of the most far-reaching science in the first years of the 21st century. And those elements simply remind us, number one, that all of creation is related through what is called the web of an unseen force. And number two, that through the web of this unseen force, somehow our inner world influences our outer world. So if we could bring together all of the understandings of the lost traditions that now are being recovered throughout the 20th and now the 21st century, this is the essence that breathes life into the possibilities as we participate in the events of our lives rather than leaving us to feel victim of the events that are unfolding around us. If in fact all of creation is related through some kind of an energy, a force, what the ancients called the web of an unseen force, number one. And number two, if this force literally mirrors in the world around us what's happening inside of our bodies, what this says to us is that each of us is playing a key role, every one of us in our lives, in the seemingly insignificant moments of our lives, at the dinner table with our families, when we're driving alone in our vehicles, at our workplace and with our friends, the way we live our lives in every moment of every day, the seemingly insignificant moments are actually pooling, collecting together into the global answer for our time in history, because the world around us is mirroring not what we do, rather what we have become from inside of our bodies. So the question is, as a scientist, and as I've had the opportunity to journey into the remote locations and the pristine mountain monasteries and the small tribes in the Andes and the Himalayas, and I hear their stories and I've looked at temple walls and read the ancient texts and spoke with the translators, I understand what they're saying. As a scientist, I have to ask myself the question, do we have any evidence that such a web actually exists? Does such a link exist? And if so, why don't we hear more about it? Has 20th or now 21st century science ever found any evidence of this web? And this is precisely where we're going with our program, because what I'd like to do is share with you a series of experiments. Experiments that are absolutely shaking the foundation of Western science and the way we understand our world today. And for those of you that perhaps may have had an aversion to science in the past, when you hear the word science, if your eyes glaze over or you start to get a little sleepy, this is fun science. This science is so amazing. It is so fun. The impact is so real in our lives that it makes us understand why we haven't looked at science from this perspective more times in the past. So I'd like to share with you three experiments. They were all performed in the early 1990s. There have been many experiments that are validated in the kinds of things that I'm about to share with you. I've chosen these three as representative experiments. And if you're like me, you'd like to know where we're going. So I'm going to share with you now what the experiments are telling us. We'll go through the experiments and then I'll summarize precisely what it is that they've shown us. These experiments are telling us in the language of Western science, they're validating our most ancient and spiritual and cherished traditions. They're saying that something inside of our bodies literally is affecting the world around us, that time and distance have absolutely no bearing upon this. Whether we're in the same room or halfway around the world, the effect is the same. And perhaps most importantly, that we may choose when and how we implement this kind of power in our lives. How many of you liked science when you were in high school? Well, that's good. This is an exceptional audience. Now, a lot of audiences, when I talk about science, I see people's eyes get big and glaze over. This is a different kind of science. If science had been more like what we're doing here, I probably would have spent a lot more time in academics. There is so much going on in so many different avenues of research. The interesting thing is, many of the researchers, they find amazing results to their work, and they are unaware of the work that other researchers are doing. So the relationships and the connections in that work are only being made. These are three experiments that were performed in the early to mid-1990s. They're just being published in mainstream media. They're interesting. They are perhaps a different way of thinking about the way we view our world as isolated experiments. When we put the three of these together, they begin to tell a story. And that story is what is shaking the foundations of Western science, not just physics, chemistry, geology, biology, the healing modalities, the peace of our world are all being linked to the experiments that you're about to see right now. Please do not be deceived by their simplicity, because everyone has a different background. I've done these. They're very high level. They are very broad. They're very general. I'll get specific in certain places. Some places they look almost like cartoons. Don't be deceived by those cartoon-like appearances. There are some very, very powerful concepts that are happening here. One of the first experiments is describing what is now being called a previously unrecognized form of energy. In the early 1990s, there was a Russian scientist. His name was Vladimir Popanin. He was a quantum biologist from Russia's Academy of Sciences in Moscow, is where he began the experiments. Popanin conducted a series of very simple experiments. However, what I think is so interesting, while the work itself is interesting, when we stop and consider that someone had to actually think about doing these things, where did they even get the idea? Where did they get the input, the intuition to create this kind of experiment to begin with? And that tells me that something very, very different, something really big is happening in our world today. Popanin began by simply taking a glass tube. So if you can envision a glass tube that's sealed on both ends and through a device that allowed him to draw all of the air out from inside of that tube. He created what's called a vacuum. So we're looking at a closed tube. It's closed on both ends. All the air is drawn out from the inside. He's created what we call a vacuum, and vacuum implies that the tube is empty on the one hand. And right there, we've already got a problem. Because what we know is that in a vacuum, something still exists. The air may be drawn out, but there's still something in that tube, and that something are little particles of light that are called photons. So in Pulpinen's tube, photons of light still existed. And what Pulpinen and the researchers wanted to determine was whether or not these little particles of light, how they were arranged inside the tube. Were they all lying on the bottom of the tube? Were they stuck to the sides? Were they all scattered around? So he devised a way to measure these. So in the vacuum, he measured the particles of light. What he found was that they were randomly scattered. That was completely no surprise, absolutely what he expected. So far, everything is okay in this experiment. Completely random distribution. The next piece of the experiment is where this gets really interesting. Because into the glass tube, into the vacuum, the researchers inserted some human DNA. So they placed some cell tissue into this tube. And the question they're asking is whether or not the human DNA will have an effect on the little particles of light. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Why would it? Because in our science today, in Western science today, there is absolutely nothing that allows for a relationship between the physical molecule of DNA and the non-physical particle of light that we call a photon. So there's nothing that allows for that interaction in conventional understanding today. This is what Pulpinen is experimenting with. He places the DNA inside the tube, take all the air out again, and what they find is absolutely amazing. What they find is that the particles of light are aligned along the axis of the DNA. In other words, the DNA, the molecule of human DNA, is having a direct measurable effect on the particles of light in this tube. Let me ask you to consider a question. What is our world made out of? At the most fundamental level, whether you're looking at your wooden table or the carpets on your floor, or you're looking at the fabric and the upholstery of your car seat, if you're listening to this in an automobile, what is our world made out of? People will say to me it's made out of vibration, and that's correct. At the most fundamental level, our world is made of light. Some of the light is moving very fast, some of it's moving very slow. The photons, the particles of light that our world is made out of, are being influenced by the human DNA. What this experiment is showing is the stuff in every cell of our body is influencing the stuff our world is made out of. And to the best of my knowledge, this is one of the very first times under laboratory conditions anything like this has ever been shown, although the ancients suggest that this relationship exists almost universally. Now, the next piece of the experiment gets really, really interesting, because the DNA is removed from the tube, and Pulpinen says, okay, we've taken the DNA out of the vacuum. What happens to the particles of light? Do they all fall to the bottom? Do they all scatter because there's no DNA holding them together anymore? When they measured the photons, the little particles of light, when the DNA was removed, what happened surprised everyone. Because although the DNA no longer existed in the tube, the particles acted as if the DNA were still there. And the question is, why? What is holding those particles in place? What are they attached to? Is there some invisible field that's holding them there? The particles remained ordered, and there's absolutely nothing in conventional Western science that describes why those particles are still held in place. Well, this is the end of the first experiment. And then the lab notes, I think, are very telling. The light is described as behaving surprisingly, counterintuitively. It says that there was one way the light was expected to behave, and what was actually being observed was very, very different from what they thought was going to happen. The lab notes go on to say that we are forced to accept the possibility that some new field of energy is being excited by the DNA. Well, my sense is it's probably not a new field. That it is a field that has existed for a long time. We simply never knew how to recognize this field. This experiment now is actually called the DNA Phantom Effect. the DNA phantom effect, because the effects last even when the DNA is no longer in the system. So this is the end of our first experiment. A summary, what did we just do? We said, number one, that a previously unrecognized form of energy exists. Number two, it appears that the DNA is communicating with matter, with the photons of light through this energy. And that's the end of our first experiment. We'll continue with more in the next session. I like to talk about military experiments, and this is one of those. This experiment was performed by the United States Army in 1993, an organization called the Intelligence and Security Command. The acronym is INSCOM. This was first reported in the TREAT 5 conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was published in the journal called Advances, Volume 9, 1993, by a gentleman named Jay Motz. What they did in this experiment, you're going to see a pattern develop here very quickly. They took some human DNA from what they call the donor. When I read about these experiments and I see the word donor, in my mind, I just make it up that it's a volunteer. I like that. Never really know, but doesn't it sound better to say a volunteer donated some DNA? They took scrapings from the inside of the volunteer's mouth, leukocytes, white blood cells, and they place this DNA into a device to measure the changes in the DNA. So right here, you can see what's beginning to happen. They're expecting that in some way, the DNA is going to change under certain conditions. They placed the DNA in a device to measure the DNA's response. Now I'll just preface this. This is the way that the whole experiment was set up. They wanted to see the change in the DNA and how that change was related to changes in the donor's emotions. So what they did, in a room like this, they took the DNA, put it into a device that would measure it. In one room of the same building, in another room of the same building, they placed the donor, and they exposed the donor to what they called emotional stimulation. The donor was exposed to really powerful video clips of wartime, graphic wartime video clips, erotic video clips, humorous video clips, all designed to elicit deep and very powerful states of human emotion. So that was the only way they could induce them, was to actually cause the donor to have them. And what they were investigating, this is an amazing thing for them to even investigate, they're saying when the donor's having his emotion in one room, is anything happening to his cells in another room? Why would it? In conventional wisdom, it says they are no longer related. Well, here's what they began to find. When the donor was having his experience, his peaks and valleys in one room, in the same moment of time, his DNA in another room was also having his peaks and valleys. So what's happening is there's an exchange of energy. When we think about energy, typically we think about energy as being generated in one place and broadcast or transmitted like radio waves or television or through a cable or fiber optic. Some way the energy gets from where it's generated to the place where it's received. And the time it takes to do that is called the lag, L-A-G. That's the lag time. What's happening here is there's no lag time. It's happening in exactly the same instant in time in the same building. Well, the military said, let's see how far we can separate the donor from his cells and still have the effect in place. Well, the military stopped when they were only 50 miles apart. There was no difference. Right after September 11th, I did a series of conferences throughout the rest of the month. And one of those conferences, I was actually presenting this material to an audience, and the scientist that designed these experiments was in the audience. If you ever read the book published in 1974, it's called The Secret Life of Plants. His name was Dr. Cleve Baxter. And he was very, very generous and very kind and very gracious with sharing with me additional studies. Cleve Baxter was working with military intelligence in polygraph technology during World War II when it was in its infancy. And we had never heard of anything like these lie detector tests before. For some reason, he intuited one day, instead of hooking these things up to a human, he hooked them up to a plant. He was going to do some experiments later in the day, but before that, he was going to have his lunch. He's in the laboratory, he's having lunch. The plants are hooked up to a polygraph, and a spider walks across his desk. And in his mind, he's thinking, I'm going to smash this spider. He never even raised his hand to do it. Just in him thinking that he was going to do it, all of a sudden the plants started going nuts on the polygraph. The plants picked up his intent to kill the spider before he even physically began the motion with his body. And he said, well, that's interesting. That led to a series of experiments that became The Secret Life of Plants, and that's what that book was written about. Subsequently, he did the same thing with humans, and now that lends itself to why they were doing these experiments. So at dinner that night, he began telling me a story. He said the military stopped at 50 miles. He said, but we didn't. He said, we did experiments where we had the donor in Los Angeles. We shipped the cells to Phoenix, about 300 miles away. He said the effect was the same. Why? Why is this DNA having an experience when the donor of the DNA is 300 miles apart and there's no lag time? What does that mean? There's nothing in conventional wisdom that allows for this. It means in some way that DNA is still connected to the donor. Think about, what does that mean for organ transplant victims? When you transplant an organ from one living person to another, is the organ that's in one human still linked to another in some way, maybe? We know we all share DNA. I've probably hugged 30 people here before we began this morning. Some of my DNA is on every one of you, and you're on me. In just a little while, we're going to go to lunch. You're going to have yours, I'll have mine. Are we still linked while we're having our lunch experience? And to some degree, is what this is saying. This information, what's happening here, the field of energy that's being utilized here was what's key in this experiment. What do these tests show us? Number one, they say that living cells communicate through a previously unrecognized form of energy. That time and distance in these experiments have no effect on the communication. They're not bound by time and space. Number three, the energy appears to be non-local. Non-local energy, if you haven't heard of it, you will hear of it. It has been the subject of National Geographic specials, Discovery specials. CNN has done specials on it. Nova, 60 Minutes, Dan Rather reports. Charlie Rose has interviewed physicists working with what is called non-local energy. What does it mean? Of the many ways we can define it, the definition I'm about to share is as good as any other. Non-local energy, it's energy that already exists everywhere, all the time, rather than an energy that's generated or created in one place. It says that we are surrounded, we are bathed in a field of energy that Western science is only beginning to understand. It's everywhere all the time, so it's not local, it's non-local. Experiment number three. Aren't these fun experiments? Experiment number three. This was done in 1993, a paper released by researchers at the HeartMath Institute. I've been affiliated with HeartMath, and we've shared information back and forth since 1991. The HeartMath Institute is considered to be the premier research institution in innovative heart-based technologies. And of all the things HeartMath has demonstrated, the primary key is that our hearts, that seven-layer liquid crystal oscillator in the center of your body, does much more than simply pump blood. And it may, in fact, be the least of some of the functions. They have demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt, our hearts are so mysterious. Do you know that your heart formed in the womb of your mother before your brain ever even formed? Your heart formed first. And it began to beat in response to something. That your heart has its own brain tissue, its own neural tissue, separate from your physical brain. Your heart has a memory. Have you read the reports about the heart transplant victims, such as the elderly woman who received the heart of a 12-year-old boy, came out of the surgery. The doctor said, "How do you feel?" And she says, "Fine, except for an unusual, atypical craving for McDonald's Big Macs and chocolate shakes," which was the favorite meal of the boy who had donated his heart. He'd been killed in an auto accident. His heart was intact. It was donated to this woman. And they said, "Well, is there a link?" And now there are books that have been written and studies done. The heart memories apparently travel with the heart to the new people. And they share those in ways we're only beginning to understand. Heart math has been instrumental in pioneering the research in this work. They've published in the Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, New England Medical Journal, New Scientist, Nature Magazine. So they're very well received. Well, there's a paper that they released, 1993, Local and Non-Local Effects of Coherent Heart Frequencies on Conformational Changes of DNA. It was published by two brilliant men, Glenn Ryan and Roland McCready, both working at that time through HeartMath. It was released at the joint USPA-IAPR Psychotronics Conference, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 1993, if you'd like to find out where the proceedings are from that. Here's what they found. First of all, HeartMath first theorized and now has proven, and this is accepted in the open literature, that surrounding every human heart is a field of energy, shaped like a donut. They call it a tube torus. The HeartMath Institute published that this field exists. This field is not a field that we would call part of the human aura or the chakra of the heart, although it may be associated with that. It's not prana. It is a measurable electromagnetic field of energy that extends between 5 and 8 feet from the center of the heart outward. And I asked Roland McCready once when we were doing some work together, I said, "Roland, why does the heart field stop at 5 to 8 feet? Why doesn't it go farther?" And he said, "You know, that's a good question." He said, "Right now we believe that is the limitation of our instruments." He said, "What the studies are showing is that in reality, this heart field extends many miles on the quantum level. Our hearts are affecting the world around us," the ancients said. Now we're beginning to understand how. Okay, well, this is already known. No big surprise here. This field was already established. What HeartMath wanted to see was, within this field, is there another kind of energy that we have previously not recognized? They designed a series of studies, 1993, searching for a non-conventional form of energy. You see a pattern developing now. They took some human DNA. Just for people who like to be very clear about how these experiments work, this DNA came from human placenta, because placental DNA is very pristine. As our DNA matures, it begins to change. And what they found was that the brand new DNA had qualities that adult, more mature DNA no longer had. And what they wanted to do was they asked themselves, when individuals intentionally have deep, powerful, coherent forms of emotion, heart-based emotion, not thoughts, heart-based emotion, does it have any effect on the DNA? Well, why would it? Why should it? There's nothing to suggest that it would, other than their curiosity of what might be happening here. They did the experiments, and what they found was that gratitude, appreciation, love, compassion, those kinds of emotions have direct, measurable effect. It actually relaxed the DNA. You know how we always think of DNA as an intertwined double helix? Those two strands together. What they found was, in the presence of gratitude and appreciation, love, compassion, those qualities of emotion, the DNA began to relax. And they found that if they continued the experiments long enough, the DNA relaxed so much it actually began to untwine itself to where the strands were no longer intertwined. Now let me just take a moment here and explain why that's important. One of the great mysteries of the life sciences is why so much human DNA appears to be unused. We have estimates go anywhere from 20 to 25% of human DNA is used. Almost two-thirds of our DNA appears to be unused. It's almost like sometime in our history, in our ancient past, something or somehow someone went through and turned certain switches off and other switches are on. We have the capability to do things and to activate other portions of DNA, and for the most part, it simply is not activated, giving us the following kinds of mysteries. Let me just ask a question. What is it that humans, apes, bats and guinea pigs have in common is mammals that no other mammals have. Humans, apes, bats, and guinea pigs are the only mammals I'm aware of right now who no longer produce vitamin C in their bodies. It's required of us. We have to have vitamin C. We have the capabilities to do it. We have all the enzymes are present in the liver. The codes are there in the DNA. They appear to be shut off. Why? Just to make this really interesting, there are humans now that do produce vitamin C. Pregnant and lactating women produce varying amounts of vitamin C. Sometimes they continue to produce it after their pregnancy. If even one person can do it, it says it's possible. Why aren't we all doing it now? Well, what researchers have found is the way that DNA is wound, the way that twisting occurs, plays a large role in how much of our DNA is turned off and how much is turned on. Now we're seeing that DNA can be loosened simply by having a deep, powerful emotion in the body, giving us, and what the research is showing, very powerful states of emotion inside that are enabling immune system. This is where our immune system is strengthened. This is where cells begin to divide and bones heal many times faster than they do under other conditions. So what do you think happens in the opposite of this? Anger, rage, hate, jealousy. Exactly what you would think. Tightens up like a little tub. What happens to people who are chronically angry, enraged, depressed? If people are still angry over a bad divorce 30 years from the time of the divorce, if you're upset about the way a particular job treated you, even after you've moved on two or three jobs after, if you hold that inside, what happens to those people? What happens to their immune systems? They're compromised. What happens to their body's ability to produce the enzymes in their body, DHEA, the precursor for all hormones? They're compromised. So we're beginning to see this relationship. This is why this is important. This is an amazing series of experiments. What they're saying in the lab notes, and this is in the published report, individuals trained in feelings of deep love and appreciation were able to intentionally change the shape of their DNA. Another way of saying what's happening right here is that under very specific forms of powerful, coherent emotions, we are impacting positively or negatively the immune system in our body and the characteristics that give life to our bodies. They went on to say that human emotion produces effects which defy conventional laws of electromagnetism in their relationship to space-time. It's saying that our emotions are working with a kind of energy that is not bound by space and time the way that we think it is. Let me ask a question. How many people have had this experience where you go to call someone that you love, you pick up the phone to dial the number, and they're already on the other end of the phone? You ever had that happen?
Oh, yeah.
Has it ever happened to you with somebody that you didn't like? I've never seen anyone or heard anyone say that it happens to someone that they didn't care for. It generally happens with people that we have a deep affinity for. My mom and I do this a lot. Well, what happens? When we have that experience, what just happened? Obviously, there was a communication on some level. What's the conduit? What's the conduit? Someone half a country or half a world away. Whatever the conduit is, it's not bound by space and time. We're talking about emotions. Summary of experiment number 3, it says that we communicate with DNA through a non-local form of energy. We're using energy that already exists. The energy is associated with human emotion, and through this energy we may intentionally change the shape of DNA molecules. That is the end of the third experiment. In and of themselves, each of those is interesting. When you put them together, they begin to tell a story. Now, to a large extent, these researchers were unaware of the work the other researchers were doing. And here's what that story says. The very first experiment with Poponen, it said that in some way, the physical molecule of human DNA is having an effect on the stuff our world is made out of. This experiment says that when we feel certain feelings in our body, we're changing the DNA that's having the effect on the stuff our world is made out of. The middle experiment says it's not bound by space and time. It can happen in the same room. It can happen 400 miles away. You put those together, it begins to describe a technology. And it's a technology I believe has been also described in our most cherished traditions. It said when we live our lives a certain way, we can expect to be happy, healthy, prosperous, productive individuals, that we can expect to have peace in our world. And when we choose to live our lives in another way, we can full well expect to see illness and disease in our body and suffering in our world. And they said that in the language of their time. So what's happening here? Researchers now that are working with this energy are saying the energy that connects all of creation appears to be a tightly woven web that makes up what they're calling the fabric of creation. It's not out there somewhere. It's here. We're part of it. It permeates all of creation. It's the stuff that's in between the nothing of our world. And we're seeing, anecdotally, in the world around us, precisely the effects that the experiments are showing under laboratory conditions. Anger, rage, hate, jealousy, all elements of fear. These are all different expressions of fear-based response. Are now giving us the mechanism showing how those kinds of emotions actually tighten up that coil of the DNA, and apparently, what the experiments are suggesting by doing so, actually shutting down key responses in our bodies. And the experiments go on then to show that these are predictable, consistent, repeatable responses. So this is an amazing series of experiments to show. The lab notes go on to document this. And this is a direct quote. Individuals trained in feelings of deep love and appreciation were able to intentionally change the shape of the DNA. I'm going to say that one more time because this is such an empowering statement to be able to share. Individuals trained in feelings of deep love and appreciation were able to intentionally change the shape of the DNA. The reason this is important is because it suggests to us that we may consciously choose a code of conduct in our lives that has a direct, measurable effect upon the health, the well-being, the cells of our bodies within us, and may extend beyond even that. The lab notes go on to say that human emotion produces effects which defy conventional laws of electromagnetism and their relationship to space and time. What these notes are saying to us is that you and I have a power within our bodies. We can feel a quality of feeling that is not bound to this world by the laws of physics the way we know them today. So I began this program with the story of a young Jewish boy and his father at the wall in Jerusalem. And the boy found at his feet a prayer that had fallen out of the wall on a piece of paper that his father had placed there before his death. And the boy found himself at precisely the same place, at precisely the moment that that piece of paper fell out of the wall. And for that to happen, there had to be a conduit between the two, whether the father was in this world or not. There was a conduit, there was a communication that was going on between them. Why are these things important? Well, what's so interesting about the way experiments occur is that often they're in laboratories with researchers who are not aware of what other researchers are doing in their laboratories. So any one of these three is interesting unto itself and warrants further study. However, when we put them all together and when we pool the results of these experiments into a common understanding, they begin to tell a story. And here's what that story looks like. The first experiment with Poponin said to us that human DNA has a direct effect on the stuff our world is made out of. The third experiment from the HeartMath Institute showed that when we feel certain kinds of feelings in our bodies, that we're having a direct effect on the DNA that's having a direct effect on the stuff our world is made out of. And the second experiment, the military experiment, suggests that whether we're in the same room or separated by great distances, that time and space have no effect on this experience. When we put all these together, we're beginning to tell ourselves the story of the way that we work in this world, and the story is beginning to suggest that there's a power, there's a force that lives within every human who's ever walked this earth. And by virtue of this force, we are empowered. And I'm not going to use the word control, and I'm not going to use the word manipulate. I'm going to say that we are empowered to participate with wisdom and discernment in the events of our lives, in the healing of our bodies, in the peace of our world, because as the ancients said, These are all linked. As different as they appear to be, they are all linked. The peace of our world, the healing of our bodies appears to be linked through a form of energy that we're only beginning to understand. In the next section, we're going to talk about precisely how this form of energy works and begin looking at how we apply it to our lives directly in ways that are perhaps surprising and to some unexpected.